Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With former UN head Kofi Annan unable to get an agreement to stop the year-long bloodshed in Syria, we'll begin with an analysis of where the civil war in Syria is heading and whether we will end up with a Somalia on the Mediterranean with remnants of the regime and rebels fighting over chemical and biological arsenals. Robert Baer, a former CIA officer who knows both sides, Syrian army generals and the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood, joins us. Then, following the HBO movie Game Change that revealed the fractious inner workings of the McCain-Palin campaign, we will examine the candidate who lost the last presidential election but has since bitterly campaigned against President Obama and his foreign policy, recently calling for a war against Iran and for a bombing campaign against Syria. A former classmate of John McCain's at the Naval Academy, who spent 8 years as a POW in North Vietnam, Dr. Philip Butler, joins us to talk about the man who is still running against Obama. Then finally, we will speak with Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of a new book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. We will discuss the appeal of damnation and destruction that America's religious right has for this apocalyptic vision of a war between good and evil, and their investment in the end times that has brought about a peculiar alliance with the right-wing government of Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm now joined by Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Good morning.
And the president seems to sort of, in spite of his high-minded pronouncements, basically the policy towards Syria is one of inaction. And he's now apparently, at least the assumption is that U.S. intelligence officials have been set loose on the press to give briefings that are basically saying that Bashar al-Assad is firmly in control and increasingly willing to use his military against the badly overmatched opposition groups. This has led to former Deputy National Security Advisor Elliot Abrahams saying that the Obama administration is politicizing intelligence on Syria to justify doing nothing. What's your understanding?
Well, you know, this thing hasn't turned out the way I expected it to, in the sense that I thought that the Arabs, especially the Gulf Arabs, start pouring money and equipment into the Syrian opposition to the rebels, but they haven't. At the end of the day, they were afraid this might escalate, that the Iranians might do the same in Bahrain. So the Syrian rebels are being starved day by day, and you know, the place has been hit by snowstorms. They run out of ammunition. They run out of medical supplies, everything. It's simply the inaction in the West and the Arab world that is putting an end to this revolt. I think, you know, it's hard to say, but once Homs was taken over by the Syrian military, and once the Syrians understood they could get away with using their elite units and their tanks to take these towns, they're going to keep going until they've got this. It's going to be very bloody. On the other hand, you know, if you look at Abrams, you know, everybody urging McCain, urging the United States to enter this, there are no clean-cut lines of confrontation. You know, that whole, from Idlib to Homs, is mixed between the two sects, between Alawites and Sunnis. And then you also have the question of the Christians are still the Alawites. They're a small minority. They've banded together, as they always have. And you have a very effective army, which is crushing this. This is something that Libya never had, an effective army. Gaddafi destroyed the army completely, whereas Assad, especially the father, Hafez al-Assad, created an army that was essentially coup-proof, capable of taking these cities back, and he could maintain the cohesiveness of elite units. And this is really, you know, paid off in the end.
So what they've done is they've crushed Homs brutally, and now they're just taking them on piecemeal. Now they're in, what is it, Ibid in the north? And
Irbila,
I mean, in the north, right? And so, and that's right next door to the sanctuaries in Turkey. What do you think the key roles are? Of course, Turkey, Qatar, who apparently have supplied arms and even a brigade, and Saudi Arabia. So, can't you look at this, Robert Baer, as a proxy war within a proxy war? In other words, the West against Putin and Russia, who steadfastly are supporting Assad and supplying him with arms. And then you've got within the Arab world, the Gulf and Saudi Arabia supporting the rebels and Iran supporting the Assad regime.
Well, you have multiple agendas here. You look at China. They're worried about the Muslims in the West, the Uyghurs, rising against China and the Tibetans. They want to establish the right for a sovereign government to go in and use heavy armor against the people. And as far as Russia goes, they want to retain the same right in the Caucasus. If there's another Chechnya, they want to be able to send the Red Army in and destroy it, you know, flatten like they did Grozny in the 90s. And so they very much ideologically side with Bashar al-Assad. The Arabs, for a while, tended to look at this conflict as, look, we lost Iraq. The invasion in 2003 essentially turned Iraq over to the Shia Muslims. And what we'll do is we'll take Syria for us, for the Sunnis, get rid of Bashar al-Assad, force the Alawites out, and we'll be even. You know, but like I said, the deeper they get into this conflict, the more over their head they are. And these people need anti-tank weapons. You know, there's a lot of them available. They have to be smuggled across the border, but it's not impossible. But facing this armor, even in a city, they will be destroyed.
So why, given the amount of money and arms that the Saudis and the Qataris, to a lesser extent, have, what's the problem? Why haven't the Free Syrian Army been better armed? Now, I understand that the entire Syrian opposition seem to be much better at arguing amongst themselves than getting their act together.
Well, I think they're divided. There's no doubt about that. You know, and there's different parts of it. In this revolt was very spontaneous. It was not created, you know, in the Gulf by the Gulf Arabs. That's an outside act revolt. It's just wrong. The Bashar al-Assad and the Alawites are making that up. But you know, you have to look at this. You know, in the Middle East, it's like playing billiards. You have to look at all the angles. And one of the angles is Bahrain. And Iran is very much committed to leaving Bashar al-Assad in power. So what the Gulf Arabs are afraid is that in some act of reciprocity, the Iranians are going to start arming the Bahraini opposition, you know, bring down that kingdom. And then you've got Kuwait and then United Arab Emirates. I think they're really, they understand they're sitting on a volcano of sectarianism in the Middle East, and they're pulling back. You know, they're keeping their fingers crossed that Iraq doesn't go up again in a major way, and that Lebanon as well, which is divided between the two sects. So I think that, you know, the caution has overtaken their rhetoric.
So, but what defense does the Obama administration have against neoconservatives like Elliot Abrams from the Chinese National Security Advisor in terms of you know, the criticism that Obama's Syrian policy is a complete failure and that essentially the Assad regime's patrons in Tehran have scored a huge victory?
Well, you know what I would do? I would tell Elliot Abrams and the rest of these people, you know, wanting another war in the Middle East, they should suit up. I spent a lot of time in American military bases, and they're always, we'll take orders and go to the next war, but they are worn out. Equipment's worn out. All of our special forces have been multiple deployments. They're tired. They've taken a lot of losses. You know, they're getting out of the military. They're not coming back to jobs. And you know, they're not whining. I'm just saying the military's of all volunteer military is worn out. And if we want to engage in these conflicts in the Middle East in a serious way to divide these forces, you'd have to bring back the draft. It's a bit of an exaggeration, I know, but that's what you'd have to do. You'd have to share the pain. Now, there are intermediate steps. You could establish no-drive zones and use cruise missiles against Syrian armor. which, you know, I think you might have to consider if this gets really bad, if it turns into a Rwandan-like ethnic cleansing, we may have, you know, as human beings, be obligated to protect these people. But that's, you know, that's a big question.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon, the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. So what about the idea then that this... if it's a stalemate now, in the well, it's not a stalemate as much as the Syrian army is rolling back the Free Syrian Army, which is a ragtag group of very brave but completely undersupplied volunteer soldiers. If they're able to launch a guerrilla war, and you know Al Qaeda, of course, is trying to get on the act because they see an opportunity, and they probably also recognize their essential irrelevance. What about this scenario that some have suggested that this could end up as a kind of Somalia on the Mediterranean?
There's a couple of Syrians that are leading the. You know, the opposition, the rebels now, and one or two of them had been with bin Laden. We know who they are, but, you know, they were sort of fellow travelers, and they were never considered, you know, mainstays of Al-Qaeda. They sort of drifted to Afghanistan, drifted to Pakistan. Now they drifted back to the Levant, to Lebanon. But I think what we're doing, we're prisoner of this propaganda that Al-Qaeda is everywhere. You know, we're looking at the Yemeni conflict as, oh, it's Al-Qaeda against the central government. That's a huge exaggeration. That country has been in one war or another for 1,000 years. And now to paint these forces in the mountains of Yemen as Al-Qaeda is not helpful. Same way with Syria. There's simply, you know, we a lot of us predicted, and, you know, I feared for sure that this was going to happen in Libya, that some sort of Al-Qaeda would arise in Libya and the chaos there and, you know, start cutting the heads off of foreigners. Well, you know, it hasn't happened. It's been chaotic, but they've kept that, you know, militant Islam is very much suppressed, and it really hasn't turned into a catastrophe. And I'm not sure Syria would either. So I think it's more than anything, this is an argument that the people are making that don't understand Syria. I served there for many years, and I don't claim to understand it. But I just don't see the militant Islamic groups taking this over in spite of the car bombs. You know, the Syrians are very sophisticated people. You know, any place in the Arab world, they're considered sophisticated. And I don't see them drifting off into, you know, some caliphate establishing itself in Damascus. I just don't see it.
Well, I don't see it either, but some people see a protracted civil war / guerrilla war where you have the Syrian army against the Muslim Brotherhood. You know both sides. You know Syrian army generals, and you know some of the leaders in the Muslim Brotherhood. Is this a situation where it's become a cycle of blood revenge, and it's likely to get more intense as opposed to less, which is what, you know, Kofi Annan's...
Yeah, I'm sort of like you and everybody else. I go by last week's scorecard, and the regime does seem to have the upper hand. And without anybody coming to the assistance of these people, and as much as you can make any call in the Middle East, I think that Bashar al-Assad will win. I don't expect a coup d'etat there. Don't expect any mercy on his part, but you're going to see these units, which are officered by Alawites. There's no Sunni. What we can't forget is there's no Sunni officer is in control of a unit that could turn on the regime. That has been bred out of the system a long time ago, 30 years ago. It's just not going to happen. So you're going to see, like, the 4th Division, the Praetorian Guard, you know, move north, take these cities back one at a time. You're going to see Bashar al-Assad making separate deals with, for instance, the Kurds. He already has. He's going to get Hezbollah in Lebanon to cut off arms supplies coming in. And again, going back to the Turks and the Gulf Arabs, they have been, it's been a lot of rhetoric on Al Jazeera, but no action.
But isn't there a broader arena here in the context of the so-called Arab Spring? It's hard not to see analogies between Syria and Egypt, for example, the same autocratic, military-based government, bunch of kleptocrats feeling...
Nothing has changed, you know, seriously. I mean, very little has changed. Ultimately, what rules the street in the Arab world is the T-72 tank. Who's ever got the tanks and the artillery can control the urban areas. That's an exaggeration, I know, a bit, but you see the same thing in China. You know, 4 June, Tiananmen Square, it was the tanks that took back Peking. You're going to see the tanks go into Western China and on in the same way with Moscow. What we're seeing more than democracy breaking out, and, you know, I'm a big supporter of democracy, but the fact is we're seeing the military has become predominant. And if the Islamists in Cairo want to get in, they're going to have to cut a deal with the Egyptian military, and they very well could. And whatever succeeds Bashar al-Assad or he stays in, it's ultimately going to be the military who says what's going to happen.
But that's not to say that what is driving this change in the Arab world is a refusal on the part of a younger generation to accept the status quo. And they've shown enormous bravery, both in Egypt and in Syria. In the case of Egypt, I think unquestionably the Islamists and the military have undercut the revolution. And in Syria, the Assad regime won't allow the revolution to continue. But that doesn't mean the impulse is going to go away.
Oh, I don't think the impulse will ever go away, but you have to look at Iran in 2009, where the impulse didn't go away, but the regime continued to control the streets with extreme violence. And that's been the model so far. And the impulse never goes away, and all these societies could stand, you know, to have some democracy and a new generation coming in, because as you said, it's a kleptocracy. And even if we don't get changes the next 10 years, important changes, this will rise again with a new generation.
So when the White House, as Hillary Clinton has and the president has had on a number of occasions, say that this regime will fall, what are they talking about? What kind of timeline is that? Are we talking about?
Oh, you know, they're talking from ignorance. Like, you know, a month ago I thought, geez, these guys can't last. But it's really, they don't have anybody in Damascus. It's hard to keep track of. They don't have anybody inside the regime that can tell them what they're thinking, what they're planning. A lot of it's rumor. And, you know, all of us in the West, unless you happen to be Syrian, you know, living in Damascus, you become prisoner of exiles or, you know, pundits or whatever. So what the White House was simply doing a month ago was projecting a trend and not any sort of inside knowledge. And, you know, I'm sympathetic in the sense that I fall trap, you know, I fall to that too.
Well, it's a bit of an irony at the end of the day that the repressive Saudi regime that you wrote about in Sleeping with the Devil, the notion that they are a force for democracy, I mean, there's so much similarities between the Assad family and the al-Saud family, it's kind of embarrassing.
Well, I mean, they were, you know, and for so many ways, the Syrians and the Saudis are attached at the hip. I mean, there's so many intermarriages between families. I mean, a Saudi royal, the first thing he does is go to Damascus and finds a wife, you know. They have a lot of emotional attachments to Damascus, and they have a lot of emotional attachment to holding on to the status quo.
Sure. Bin Laden himself went to Syria to look for a wife.
His mother was Syrian.
Right. Well, I thank you so much. Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the grim briefing, but a realistic one nevertheless. Again, right. I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife, Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the real John McCain.
زخ رصاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد اعتقلن كيف زخ رصاص على
Come you masters of war You that build the big guns You that build the death planes You that build all the bombs You that hide behind walls You that hide behind discs I just don't want you
Welcome back, I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and joining us now is Dr. Philip Butler, who was a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Heart Medals. He completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Today, he's a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace, and his website is philipbutlerphd.com, and his autobiography is 3 Lives of a Warrior. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Philip Butler.
Good morning, Ian. Thank you for inviting me this morning, and also I want to thank you for calling me a little early and let me tune in on your interview with Robert Baer. He's a brilliant and interesting guy, and I really enjoyed the interview and could even foresee some things that you guys talked about that tie in with our old friend John McCain.
Well, given that he's not only does John McCain want to go to war against Iran, he's calling for a bombing campaign against Syria. In the movie last night on HBO Game Change, there was an interesting moment in the movie where, towards the end, where John McCain, after he's lost, says, you know, look, my grandfather. He died the day after World War II ended because he'd lost his mission, was over, and he simply dropped dead. And my father, when he retired, Admiral McCain, when he retired, he was completely lost. And I don't want to end up that way. I'm going to keep on fighting. Well, it sure looks like he's not only keeping on fighting, he's keeping on campaigning. It feels like he never gave up campaigning against Barack Obama.
Yeah, I think that he really dislikes and distrusts Barack Obama when it comes down to the bottom line. Listeners might not know that John McCain and I were briefly at the Naval Academy for the same time. I was a plebe or fourth classman at the Academy, and John was a first classman. And ironically, that life is stranger than fiction. John and his roommate lived right across the hall from me, albeit there were 3,000 of us midshipmen, but I was in the 17th company with John, and so got to know him that year. And then, of course, some years later, he followed me into the Hanoi prison system. He served 5.5 years there as a POW, and so I was there a couple of years ahead of him. But at the time that we were at the academy, I would certainly call him a friend, had interesting experiences with him, but afterwards that all changed because, in my opinion, John McCain never learned the lessons of war after even all of his experiences in Vietnam. So, you know, I really honestly think that our nation dodged a huge bullet when John and his handlers decided to select Sarah Palin, who turned out to be an airhead, and probably kept him from being elected, because I think if McCain were president right now, we would be not backing down from two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. We would be heavily embroiled in probably four wars, and who knows how that could have expanded throughout the Middle East. But I think he would have upped the ante in Afghanistan, Iraq, and probably by now we would have bombed Syria and Iran, or maybe along the way we would have dropped some bombs in Libya, too. I don't know, but he just is so bellicose. It's incredible.
Well, it's interesting that the film, HBO film last night, Game Change, I think pretty much makes the case that Sarah Palin brought down the ticket at the same time, of course, energized the Republican base. And it really, what was left hanging there was one of his aides tells him early when he's about to make the choice that you know, you're supposed to be the man of integrity and the maverick, and you're doing something for purely transparent electoral reasons, as opposed to who is a suitable vice president, which is what the Constitution demands.
Yeah, well, I think there's another, just knowing John personally, I think there's another element there, too. I think, quite frankly, you know, if I put myself in his shoes during that time where they were trying to select a vice president, I think that Sarah Palin's sexuality may have had something to do with the choice, because there was John McCain and then all those other guys who were supposedly vetting her, and I think they were all hornswoggled by her glib talk and by her cutesy sexuality and her beauty.
Well, that's a very interesting observation, and I think in many ways a very accurate one. Philip Butler, again, a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He spent eight years as a POW in North Vietnam, knew John McCain in both contexts, and is a highly decorated combat veteran with two Silver Stars, two Legions of Merit, two Bronze Stars, and two Purple Hearts. Is now a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. His website is philipbutlerphd.com, and his autobiography is Three Lives of a Warrior. So how much, though, is McCain, and he seems to be working in tandem with Lindsey Graham. They were in many ways behind this push for the National Defense Authorization Act that the president threatened to veto, not because of its intrusion into domestic civil liberties, but because it would tie his hands on forcing a confrontation with Iran, which would then drive up the price of oil in an election year. We can see that that's already happening, although a lot of the price of oil is being gamed on Wall Street by speculators. What's your sense of how ruthless these guys are in terms of their determination to get rid of Obama, which seems to be very, very deeply felt in the Republican Party? Do you think that they're prepared to throw away any vestiges of bipartisanism?
Oh, I think they are. I think the Republican Party right now is heavily invested. Both parties are invested, but the Republican Party is probably the most heavily invested in the military-industrial complex. I mean, if you look at the Middle East as a whole, and you back off some distance and take your vision off the various fires that are going on in the different places and everything, you know, our involvement there is largely because of a three-letter word, OIL. And it's a need for oil, and the whole military-industrial complex that drives that thing and has got us embroiled, engaged in Vietnam was called a quagmire. This is a quagmire of epic proportions, even compared to Vietnam. The quagmire of the 1,200-year-old battle between the Sunnis and the Shias, and we're stuck right in the middle of all of this stuff.
Well, but the war that McCain and the neoconservatives supported, and after all, you know, he's his advisors, Randy Schoenemann and his foreign policy advisors, were out of the neocon camp. They're the ones who came up with Iraq. And what has Iraq done for American oil companies? What, I mean, look at the cost of Iraq, both in terms of lives and treasure. And what has the U.S. got out of it? It's just made Iran stronger.
Yeah, exactly. It has, of course. We played right into the hands of Iran. We've served their interests greatly. I mean, Iran and Iraq fought a devastating war for, I don't know, a half dozen years or more, and just a slaughterhouse of a war between the two of them. And then we came in there and knocked off Saddam Hussein, who was the guy that perpetrated the war with Iran. So, you know, we did the dirty work really for Iran, and it was all about oil because we were afraid that Iraq was, and Saddam Hussein were going to come back and take over Kuwait, which again is oil, and, you know, then the whole thing was really cooked up by the Bush administration, and I say administration, but that was before George Bush was even elected. Those Rumsfeld and Bush and Cheney and company, they had already figured out a plan and plotted for invading Iraq even before he was elected.
Well, all of that is true, and it's just they should be indicted as war criminals. But they also, the point I'm making is, they also should be pilloried for their incompetence. Not that I'm justifying their motives and what they wanted to do, but the fact that they were such a manifest failure. And these are people who wear the flag, wrap themselves in the flag and talk about patriotism and try to claim the patriotic high ground. But if you give them the reins of power, they bring nothing but disaster upon the United States and nothing but a reversal in the national security of this country.
Yeah, I think being in positions of power is highly corruptive. You know, in that in the movie Game Change, supposedly John McCain's motto was going to be country first. Well, he, you know, ever since he's been in Congress, he's been a senator. He has never been country first. It's been Republican Party first. And his job is a senator first. And then his, you know, moving up to possibly becoming president of the United States first, well, long before country first. So that all of that stuff is just Hollywood fluff that, you know, propaganda that's put up for the people to swallow, along with the Sarah Palin. You know, we saw her in the movie being Hollywoodized. They tried to dress her up prettier, you know, in expensive clothing, and then the word got out on how much had been spent on her clothes. And just a bunch of nonsense. It really had nothing whatsoever to do with any of the issues.
Well, but just in closing, it does seem that from your analysis, Dr. Philip Butler, that McCain is the Republican point man on national security. His job it is to do whatever he can. I mean, he said the most outrageous stuff about Obama's handling of Iraq, and the American people are quite happy to get out of Iraq. But if you listen to John McCain, it's the biggest, you know, withdrawing from Iraq was the worst catastrophe in American history. Getting into Iraq was clearly the worst catastrophe.
Absolutely. Oh, my God, yes.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Philip Butler.
Well, thank you, Ian. I enjoyed it, and hope to talk to you again sometime.
Indeed. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Philip Butler, a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Today, he's a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace, and his website is philipbutlerphd.com, and his autobiography is 3 Lives of a Warrior. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Book of Revelation.
Burning, I see Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in a second chance? Do you believe in rapture, boy?
was wrong, but you said it was right. In the future, I will read at night. In the neon bulb, the neon bulb, not much chance for survival. If the neon bulb is true.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elaine Pagels, who's a professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of many books, including The Gnostic Gospels, Reading Judas, and the New York Times bestseller Beyond Belief. She's the author of the new book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elaine Pagels.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
And clearly, your subtitle, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation, politics, of course, there's quite a considerable constituency in this country that believes in the Book of Revelation. At least some of the more prominent televangelists, you know, profess it and propound it quite often. And there is an alliance, if you will, between conservative politics in Israel and conservative politics here that's in many ways based on the Book of Revelation. But it seems, and your book is very welcome, that very few people have, one, read it, right, and two, understand it.
Well, the Book of Revelation, it's a 2,000-year-old book, so it's hard to read a book like that unless you get some of the context, actually. What fascinates me is just what you mentioned, that people today and people for 2,000 years have been reading that book and reading their own situations into it. And I've been, part of the reason I wrote the book was to understand how that happens.
Well, you also, though, point out in your book that there were other versions of it that weren't so apocalyptic and stark. And I also understand that the book never made it into the Eastern Church. So why is that? Why did the Eastern Church not include it in what we call here in Hollywood the final cut?
Well, the Book of Revelation's always been very controversial, even from the time it was written, and it was controversial among Christians right after it was written. Some people said it was written by a heretic. Some people said it was written by a disciple of Jesus. I mean, it's been intensely debated all the way. And that's a good question. What we now know, as you mentioned, is that there are many other books of Revelation. They're not the same one. But there's a Jewish one called The Revelation of Ezra, written by another prophet, very much at the same time as John and in the same circumstances. It's wartime. And then there are many other books of Revelation that aren't about the end of the world. So I was puzzled by that question you raised. I mean, how did this one get in?
Well, just to get the context, though, it was written, the one that made the cut, if you will, was written by John of Patmos 30 years after the death of Jesus Christ, at the time of the devastation of Jerusalem and the sack by the Romans of the great temple. And in many ways, it reflected the revulsion of the early Christians, if indeed that was what they were, of the decadence of Rome.
Well, in a way, but it wasn't the decadence that disturbed John so much and others. It was the way that Roman armies brutally put down a revolution against Roman rule in Judea. As you said, that was the Jewish revolution against Rome that occurred 66 to 70, about 35 to 40 years after Jesus' death. And John writes the images he does about the great whore of Babylon, the beast with seven heads, the monsters, the great dragon, as traditional prophetic images of Rome. That is, and of, you know, in the ancient prophets, it was Babylon that was characterized that way, or Egypt, the nations that are enemies of Israel.
So how did it get its current connection to Israel? Because, you know, the pastors like John Hagee and others,
yes,
take tours of their followers, and obviously, you know, they don't do it all for free. They have both a political alliance with the Likud party, if you will, or conservative elements. I understand that Yitzhak Shamir, the previous Israeli prime minister, basically said, we need to make an alliance with Christian fundamentalists in the United States because they're the most reliable allies that we could have amongst the Goyim. I mean, I'm roughly quoting what he said. And there seems to be a political alliance there.
Well, it's true. It's true. But, you know, there isn't just one group that uses the book. Some use it in the extreme way that you mentioned, and they understand it as a defense of Israel against its enemies. And that's not a total misunderstanding, because John was writing that way. even today you can see in Jerusalem the destruction of the temple, the stones that the Roman soldiers threw down. So, but, you know, the way John writes is in these kind of wild nightmare images, which he draws from prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel. And so he's picturing a war of good against evil. And when you picture a war of good against evil, you can sort of plug into that any conflict you have. It can be a conflict within a society. It can be a conflict within a nation. It can be a conflict between nations. So, in fact, many people have understood that it is wartime literature, and they read the religious wars of Europe between Catholics and Protestants. They read the Civil War on both sides. People read it. The Battle Hymn of the Republic is a Union Army hymn taken out of this book of Revelation. They read World War II out of it on both sides, by the way, Hitler's side and the opposition, and even the war in Iraq. So this is not new, but it's a particular way of looking at conflict that basically says we, whoever we think we are good and right, and they, whoever we call them, are evil and bad, and we can't negotiate. We have to destroy them.
Well, indeed, you could add the Cold War to that, because remember Gog and Magog was a big part of the Cold War, white hats on our side versus the black hats on the Soviet side. Again, I'm speaking with Elaine Pagels, professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of many books, including The Gnostic Gospels, Reading Judas, and the New York Times bestseller, Beyond Belief. She's the author of the new book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. But even though it can be adapted, and it has been, to wars, and even as recently as the Iraq War, where does the notion of the end of times come from? I mean, because one of the great ironies here is, of course, that in many ways, the much-reviled Ahmadinejad, the Iranian leader, he has an apocalyptic Islamic vision of the return of the Messiah, the hidden Imam. And there are just inescapable echoes of the Christian belief in the return of the Messiah.
It's absolutely true. And, you know, this comes from, basically, it comes from the Hebrew Bible. Both the Christian and Muslim views are derived from the idea that, you know, at the end of the world, God is going to judge the world and judge the righteous and the wicked, and finally divine judgment will come. Now, that's a very natural hope if you're the people being horribly persecuted and oppressed, as John and his and other Jews were in the first century, or and followers of Jesus were, because the Roman state thought they were seditionists, which was the charge under which Jesus was crucified as well. So that's a kind of desire for justice. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. also used that image, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. So I'm just saying, if you look at the book of Revelation and the hope for divine judgment from the viewpoint of people who are being tortured and killed, that's one thing. But as you point out, if you look at it from the viewpoint of people who are doing the torturing and killing, it becomes a very different kind of thing.
So what, though, I know it's all about the interpretation, but in much of what goes on Christian television, if you watch Christian television, a tremendous amount of it is focused on Book of Revelation, so almost as if it's the only book. And I know, you know, there's a connection between fundraising and fear. I think that's a pretty obvious and a well-tried technique, that the more you alarm people, the more they're likely to cough up donations to the church. But in many ways, it feels like a kind of spiritual pornography to me, that the notion that my world ends in burning flesh in order for their world to begin. And I've spoken to people who've written about this before, and they've gone on these tours of with Christian fundamentalists to Israel. And, you know, a lot of the people that are drawn to this weird cult of death, if you will, are engineers. They go out and measure where the lake of blood will be and the lake of fire and how deep the blood will be and all of this strange stuff. I mean, first of all, let's deal with the hubris angle of it. I mean, isn't it a bit of an insult that we all have to, you know, burn up in the lake of fire in order for this world of the righteous to begin?
Well, when you put it in that way, and you're talking about people who are very extreme in their views. I see what you mean. You know, I was trying to understand how do people read it this way and, you know, how the imagery of the book works. One of the things that does concern me about the way people use this book, and I really share that with you, is that, you know, the whole point of the Book of Revelation, this huge cosmic war, Jesus coming with the armies of heaven to destroy the world and pour God's wrath upon it, and it ends up with the lake of fire and the heavenly Jerusalem. So, and then it basically says, and who goes into the lake of fire? The Book of Revelation says the abominable, the filthy, the dogs, the evildoers. Now that, these are just epithets. They're kind of insults. They're not about what people have done. So you can apply that to almost anybody you don't like. You know, on the other hand, it's been read by people who see it as a hope for justice. So I think there's a range. But what I do like, and I think we share this too, is that many of the other books of Revelation, which were destroyed, speak of a universal vision of human beings, which is a very different vision than, you know, the good and the evil, the saved and the damned, which is the way we've been, sort of our culture has taught us to think for a long time.
So why do you think, then, the more humane, the more hopeful, God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, that version didn't make it? Is it because the religion was still in its you know, youthful era, if you will, and the way to get adherence is again, going back to that analogy, the way to get your congregation to pay attention is to threaten them with death as opposed to seduce them with life.
Well, what you quote, God shall wipe away all the tears, that beautiful picture of the heavenly Jerusalem is in there still. And that has also appealed to many people as a vision of hope when they're suffering terrible oppression. So, you know, when you're on the losing side of an awful war, this book can sound like it makes a lot of sense. And I think for John, that was the situation. The people who put it in the New Testament were trying to achieve the unity of the group. And that's what you're suggesting about how this language can unify people or scare people, you know, into that communion. But it's, anyway, what fascinates me is that we have many more sources in the early Christian movement, and I think they were left out because they weren't useful for creating a kind of unified social coherence against an enemy, which works pretty well, as you know.
Again, I'm speaking with Elaine Pagels, professor of religion at Princeton University, author of the new book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Why is it, though, and this is a world that you've studied for some time, Elaine, why is it that so much of contemporaneous writings have not made it? One of the things that always fascinates me is the Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, you know, a vast bureaucracy seemed to have grown up out of that, and they've been dribbling that stuff out forever. And you just get the feeling that for scholars of this era, our all the texts out now? I don't mean to be conspiratorial, but I just don't understand why it is that they've been so truculent about releasing the Word of God, if you will.
Well, it's pretty simple, actually. When I was in graduate school, there were certain people who had control of certain texts from the Dead Sea, and it had a lot to do with scholarly one-upmanship. That is, somebody who had the temple scroll, I'm not going to name him, but he was an important person in the government in Israel, defense minister, had the temple scroll, and he didn't let anyone at his university, the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, or at Harvard or anywhere else, look at it because he wanted to have the honor of publishing it first. He kept it for many years, decades. And so there's a simpler reason for that. But the Dead Sea Scrolls were the writings of a small sect who opposed the majority, who were compromising with the Roman Empire. And the Romans completely wiped them out.
But again, how would they relate to the other contemporaneous versions of the Book of Revelation that you've studied?
Well, that's a good question. The people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls have many writings in which they predict that the evil forces have taken over the world and they're now going to be challenged by God's forces and the angelic armies, and God will bring about the final justice in a new world. And that vision is something that apparently Jesus of Nazareth and John the Baptist shared with the Essenes. They could have learned it from the Essenes. Because they all hoped that the world was about to be transformed. And this book of Revelation is very much in that kind of mode.
So just in closing, I mean, one of the things that's I find extraordinary about religion in the, and how it's practiced in the United States is that so much of it feels like either a front for right-wing politics or it's been captured by the right, and it's the so-called religious right. And as you know from the current primaries on the Republican side, it's a, something of a battle between Rick Santorum and Gingrich, to a lesser extent, representing the religious right, and the Mormon candidate, the more pragmatic one, although he's reaching out as much as he can to this constituency who seem to be deciding his fate. But then you have statistics like, I don't know, something up over a third of the people in this country believe that somehow the dinosaurs were on Noah's Ark. So give me an understanding of why it is that there's so little critical thinking here and so much blind faith.
Well, that's a really good question. And I think this book doesn't appeal to critical thinking. It appeals to fear and hope. And I think that, you know, this book is not the possession of one part of the Christian communities. It's also, I'm going to give a lecture next week at the Getty Museum and one at Caltech showing paintings.
Tell us about the Getty, because this is being broadcast in Los Angeles.
Oh, yes. Well, I'll be at the Getty, I think it's next Monday. And
Monday
next week. Right.
Okay.
And showing, you know, the art, the music, and the amazing cultural impact of this book. It's, you know, mystics and William Blake and Michelangelo and contemporary artists engage this book. It's not just the people you mention. It appeals to an enormous spectrum of people. But I think you're right that it appeals to us emotionally. As one of your remarkable colleagues at the University of Southern California, Professor Antonio Damasio, shows about the brain. Mm-hmm. He says that much of our thinking is driven by emotion, and I think this book is a kind of brilliant illustration of that.
Well, just in closing then, Elaine Pagels, not to be too cynical or skeptical, I recall at the time of the Chernobyl disaster in then Ukraine and in the former Soviet Union, that somebody mentioned that in the book of Revelation it refers to the wormwood destroying the land. And, of course,
yes.
The word for wormwood in Ukrainian is Chernobyl.
Yes, yes. Well, you're right. I mean, what I found fascinating is that the images John uses are what one poet said to me are open symbols. It's monsters, the great horror, the giant beast, the number 666. These are such wide-open images that you can read so many different kinds of conflict into them, and that's one of the things I want to show. It gives you a sense of the power of this book, for better and for worse, for that matter.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Well, thank you. It's been good talking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Elaine Pagels, who's a professor of religion at Princeton University and the author of many books, including The Gnostic Gospels, Reading Judas, and the New York Times bestseller Beyond Belief. She's the author of the new book, Revelation, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with former CIA veteran Robert Baer, who knows both sides of the Syrian civil war. He knows Syrian army generals, and he's in touch with the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he gave us a pretty sobering analysis of where this civil war is heading and the likelihood that the Assad clan are going to win, and that the Saudis and the Qataris, who are supposedly helping the Free Syrian Army, are basically all rhetoric and very little action, that the arms that the Syrians need, the Syrian rebels need, aren't getting to them, and Assad is brutally crushing them. And frankly, the White House, of course, is coming under criticism. John McCain wants to bomb Syria. And there is a disconnect between the White House's rhetoric that Assad is going to fall and the fact that they basically are doing nothing while he slaughters his people, not to suggest that an intervention is in any way practical. But the long and the short of it is that this is a very sobering view of where the so-called Arab Spring has come. There's a lot of similarities between Egypt and Syria, in as much as you had these kleptocratic regimes. But clearly, in the case of Egypt, the revolution has been stolen by the Muslim Brotherhood and the military. And in Syria, it's being crushed by brutality. And Bob Baer's basic argument is that if you have control, the tanks are in the street, whether it's Tiananmen Square or in Syria, you are in charge. Then we talked about the HBO movie Game Change with somebody who's known John McCain since the days at the Naval Academy. Dr. Philip Butler joined us. He was a POW in North Vietnam for 8 years, much longer than McCain, has known him since the academy, thinks he's a dangerous man. He's very grateful that McCain never became president. He feels that if McCain had won the elections, in many ways, he thanks Sarah Palin for the fact that McCain didn't, that we'd be in war, not just in Iran, not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but in Iran and in Syria and God knows where else. Very sobering analysis by Dr. Philip Butler, who basically was referring to the HBO Game Change movie, made an interesting remark that he thinks the reason that they chose Palin was that all these men were bowled over by her sexuality, which is an interesting reflection of certainly wasn't in the movie. But basically, this guy who knows McCain says he's a bitter and angry man and has always been a danger, even going back to the days of the Naval Academy. And then finally, I spoke with Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University. She's written a new book, Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. So finally, we get an actually somebody who knows about the Book of Revelation, as opposed to these fundamentalist preachers who shake down their followers for money, promising the end of the world. It's the much more complicated history and interesting history in many ways, and very little, of course, is known about it, and it doesn't necessarily isn't quite as bleak and apocalyptic as it is portrayed. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and download this program. If you've woke up an hour late today, you can catch it at ianmasters.com soon. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.